Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Lisa Scottolini has written 32 novels, and she's best known for her legal thrillers, including the Rosato and Associates series about women who are partners at a law firm. Her latest book, Someone Knows, is a standalone novel that tells the story of five teenagers whose lives are shattered after a dangerous prank goes wrong. Lisa also writes a weekly column for the Philadelphia Inquirer with her daughter. Those columns have been adapted into a series of memoirs, including Why My Third Husband Will Be a Dog. Lisa talks this hour with Michigan radio producer and host of the program Stateside, Cynthia Canty. Cynthia asked Lisa to describe her latest book.
Well, I like to, you know, when you get to be as old as I am, 63, I'm telling you right up front, somebody has to say, but you don't look it.
Yeah, but you don't look
you don't
it.
Look, you look back in your life and I go, you know, what was I thinking? You know, you think about dumb things you did when you were young, like one was that I hitchhiked. If I missed the school bus, I hitchhiked. Other less relatable examples are my first two marriages.
What was
to
I thinking?
One and thing two. What were you thinking? I said my first two as if I have a third. I don't. So what happened is I was looking back and going, what were you thinking? And I think we have all done stuff that is not really super smart when we're younger and we think we're invincible. And so I sort of wanted to write about that. Yeah. So briefly, the story starts back in time when these five teenagers are all together and they pull a really stupid teenage prank which goes horribly, horribly wrong. And one of the girls who isn't sort of, you know, one of these things is not like the others, like they're the cool kids, but she's a little bit of an outsider. That
she's
would be
an outie.
Me. Yeah, she was being Latin Club, like I reek of Latin Club.
Latin Club?
Latin Club.
Girl! And French horn player.
Oh, well.
Can I hear it from
that's
the French
talent.
Horn player?
That is talent.
But yes, Latin Club.
So here she is, and she feels, so this horrible tragedy occurs, and she, as kids, they always say, oh my God, the worst thing is getting caught. They all scatter. Mm-hmm. But it turns out, in the next 20 years of her life, she realizes that the worst thing is not getting caught. So for the next 20 years, she beats herself up. She punishes herself. All of my books explore justice and family. Yes. And this sort of answers the question, where is justice when there's no punishment? What is the role of punishment in justice? And I think to sum up, we'd like to think of law as leading to justice and justice as punishment. You know, we say somebody went to jail,
yeah.
There's punishment. But I
there's
think
justice.
It's
yeah.
Exactly. There's a deeper question. It's a more nuanced question than that, and that's what I tried to do in this book.
All right, and we are promising you all a spoiler-free conversation because
right.
We want you to go through the pages and unfold the story. But could we start by having you read, just give us a little taste and,
okay.
And read a little bit.
You want me to sit down or stand up?
Oh, I do whatever you love to do.
You know, like in kindergarten, they go,
I know.
I love when they do that. I got to stand up because I'm a born trial lawyer.
There you go. Once a trial
in
lawyer.
In fact, I can't even use the podium. Prologue. I wrote a prologue for the first time in a long time. I was trying to be cool. This is Dark Lisa. Light Lisa sits in the chair, but Dark Lisa stands up. Nobody tells you that you'll do things when you're young that are so stupid, so unbelievably stupid, so horrifically stupid that years later you won't be able to believe it. You'll be on your laptop or reading a book or pumping gas and you'll find yourself shaking your head because you'll be thinking, no, no, no. I did not do that. I was not a part of that. That could not have happened. You'll tell yourself that you were young, that you were drinking, that good teenagers make bad decisions all the time. But you know that's not it. You know that when teenagers get together, something dark can take over. Call it peer pressure. Call it collective idiocy. Call it something more primal and monstrous, like whatever makes frat boys haze their so-called brothers to death. Writ large, it makes Nazis murder millions and soldiers torch Vietnamese villages. But whatever you call it, it'll make you do the worst thing you ever did in your life. And in your darkest moments, you will wonder if it made you do it or simply allowed you to. You know this now, but you didn't then, and you'll shake your head thinking, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I was a part of that, but you were. And not in Nazi Germany, My Lai, or a frat house, but in the safest place you can imagine. in the suburban housing development where you grew up, specifically in a patch of woods mandated by township zoning, confined by fences, and bordered by the Pennsylvania Turnpike. In other words, a completely civilized location where even nature herself is domesticated and nothing ever happens, except this one night. Dun, 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 dun. Yes.
You should.
Jaws.
You know
what
I hear?
The shark and the shark.
I hear the dick wolf. Bump, bump.
Bump, bump. Yeah.
Bump, bump.
Right.
And did I understand that the seed for this was Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment?
Yes, because that sounds so classy, and this is kind of NPR-y.
Gosh, it does.
Yes, because I think I've always thought about, you know, as a lawyer and also as a citizen. I mean, justice is an interesting question. It's not confined to lawyers at all. In fact, you're probably better off without the law degree. You know, any headline you look at, kids in cages, what is justice? It becomes an issue that is ethical and moral, and it's about right and wrong. And so I'd like to explore those questions, and I think everybody does to a certain extent.
It is so much a sense of taking you back to high school. So we have the five high school kids. There's Allie, Sasha, David, Julian, and Kyle. So the two girls and the three boys. And for each of them, there's parents and other family members. So you have all of these various threads, and you weave them together like this gorgeous, detailed piece of embroidery. All these planes are flying around, and you land them all by that last page. So before you sit down to write, have you got a roadmap? Or do you just sit down and see where the story takes you?
Well, first off, wasn't that nice? Thank you for that.
Oh, it's true. Yeah.
Look, you could know me 3 minutes and know I'm not a roadmap kind of girl. Although I got my roots done just in time for book tour.
Yay!
Check it, baby.
Oh, and I was doing mine last Saturday.
I'm like, come on, you can't go to Traverse City and look like a...
What was the question? Yeah, just
I started my life, I had been a lawyer and I became a writer when my daughter was born and my first divorce happened. So you know I'm not a good planner. And I don't plan a novel either. I've done 30 novels the exact way. And the authors I've met, there's half and half. There's half of the people who do an outline, and God bless them, they're awesome. But they're not me. I start with this idea.
Wow.
And I go, people say, do you know how it ends? No, I don't even know how it middles. You know, like,
okay.
Are you impressed yet? It's terrible because I think when people read me or I come out and I disillusion you completely. And
no, I'm enthralled that you can do that because, as you'll see, all of these work together. We were talking about Game of Thrones. I know if you're tired of Game of Thrones, too bad. I'm a Game of Thrones nut. I will Game of Thrones you for hours. But the thing that's so amazing is to see things that happen in season one, and it all plays out. It's going to all play out in this final 8th season. To me, that's such skillful storytelling, where you're like, oh my God, and this happened, and you see it land, and you do. You bring it all home, and I thought I had this vision of a back to TV again, a Homeland Carrie Matheson style wall where she's got all of these cards and she knows how it connects. So it just unfolds for you.
Well, I try to. I actually just say, what would each character do next? So I actually sort of have a theory that, you know, you'll hear people talk about writing, and they'll say there's plot, and there's character and voice, and they'll talk about these as if they're three different things. And it wasn't until like some midpoint in my life when I realized they're actually the same piece. Like we used to say, mind and body are related, and now we sort of understand that your state of mind is your state of health. Yeah. So character and plot and voice are all the same thing. So I'm trying to figure out what the character does next, and whatever he or she does defines who she is. Mm. Like briefly, an example. I think I actually picture a lot of times a room. And imagine right now we're in this room and it's all nice and we're telling stories and you know her and I'm new to you and some horrible person walks in. Well, let's tell earlier than that. We'll tell you the first chapter. We'll see a guy, he's unloading, he parked in the back in the little parking lot and he gets out of his trunk and he's got like a bag and it's a big long bag and the reader's gonna know right away, uh-oh, there's a gun in that bag, what's he gonna do? Okay, so let's say he's gonna come in and he's gonna start shooting. It's awful to think about. Everyone is going to react, and this is just when I'm writing and I think of this, I go, well, they're gonna react to a stimulus, they're gonna react to an event, what are they gonna do? And that defines who they are. So for example, some of us will run, some of us will reach for our phones and call 911, some of us will throw ourselves in front of our children, you know, and that defines and that's the best way to show the reader who the character is, through the action they take. I must say, just to wind it up, I think a little bit it's like life. where you don't really know where life will lead you, and the events happen to you. You know, my mother passed, as we all, yeah. I'm a different person. I'm just different. And I'm always trying to look at how do the events in the book affect the people in the story, inform who they are, and in the case of someone knows, inform them over time, because the decision yes. they make changes who they are.
As you're preparing to write, when I think of these characters, because they are all very real and very vivid, and I think of how actors, as they're approaching a role, do character studies, and they think about everything that may have gone into that person's life, their character's life, to bring them up to that. Do you kind of construct all of that in your mind so you're starting down the path?
That's absolutely right. And as I go along, so as soon as I had the idea for this book, I said, well, then you're going to have to go back in time. And I actually went to a local high school, not my high school, but I was in the cafeteria, and it smelled just like my high school cafeteria, which you will know that smell, like how you know the pool, like the pool smell.
Oh, God, yes.
Right, so the cafeteria.
And you had to be in a bathing suit.
Yeah. Oh, right, those yucky bathing suits, right. They come in a bin. What? Anyway.
Yes.
They're maroon. They scratch. What are they made of?
And it showed your thighs.
Right. That's a nightmare.
It is. Yeah.
So here you are, and I found myself in the cafeteria, and it smells vaguely like cream corn and Clearasil. You know, like, do you still have Clearasil? And I'm like, oh, my God, I was instantly transported.
Yeah.
And so because the real point is, when we talked about character before, by we, I say me, now you know why I'm divorced twice. but it's really... You're trying to find the emotional truth in that character.
Yes.
You have to, it's not a literal truth because she doesn't exist, but the emotional truth of this moment where you yes. get out of the cafeteria line and you're holding your tray and you look around and where do you sit? Now I will tell you, I have that feeling still at weddings. I go to a wedding, I'm single,
yeah.
I'm extremely single. I'm dead below the waist, but I won't go into that. And I go to a wedding, I go, I don't know anybody, and I don't know where to sit, and I haven't even danced with. And you have a little bit of, oh, where's the cream corn? Like, it's got to be around here somewhere. So that emotionality,
yeah.
And it's nice that you laugh, because sometimes I secretly say, in the nonfiction humor I write, if it doesn't make me cringe, it won't make you laugh. That laugh yeah. is the spark of is what I love about people. That's why I'm such a people person. You recognize the truth of that statement.
Oh my God, yes.
And if I can really think for a minute in my little house on my farm in Pennsylvania, what is the truth of that feeling for each character, and lay it bare, then people will recognize it. That's the magic of books. That's the magic of the arts.
Well, I want to talk about high school and the world of outies and mean girls, and particularly Allie Garvey. So as we meet Allie, who is very central to this, she's running cross country, she's in high school, and she falls and turns her ankle. And the class queen bee, Sasha Barrow, stops running to eye Allie. So here's the moment when they start talking. I'm going to quote from your book.
Ooh.
She didn't know how to act around Sasha Barrow, who was wearing blue mascara. Allie hadn't even known that mascara came in colors. Sasha wasn't sweating and smelled like vanilla. Allie sweated like a pig and smelled like cellulite. And then one of the dreamiest boys in the class comes by, David Hybrinsky. Sasha pulled Allie to her feet, looping an arm around her shoulders, and started down the hill with her while Allie smoothed her hair back, trying to look good, thought this wouldn't have been the day she'd pick to meet David Hybrinsky. She'd sweated off her flesh-toned Clearasil, and her long brown curls frizzed. At least her braces were finally off and her eyes were a nice blue, but boys weren't into eyes. She pulled her damp t-shirt away from her body so David couldn't see the blubber that made her belly button into a big O like a mouth shouting, "Look at my fat!" Okay, so were you with me at Ferndale High School in 1968?
I lived that.
Oh,
I
my
lived
God.
That.
Lived
really,
it.
That's very kind of you to
and,
think that.
And,
that
and,
paragraph
and
took me like 85 years to write.
Seriously, and the queen bee, mean girl, and Sasha, I had no problem thinking of the cheerleaders that glided up and down, not talking to me, people that I knew in kindergarten when we were in Brownies, but they were cheerleaders, so I couldn't breathe their air. It was so real, so, so real. So you do a tremendously wonderful job of creating these real characters.
Thank you.
And something dark does take over. So how was high school for you?
Well, weirdly, I was, you know, I like to say that I was a product of a really warm, loving Italian-American household. We had a lot of meatballs and a lot of hugs. We had one book. What was the book?
The Bible.
No, the book was TV Guide. It was not the Bible. I'm sorry to say it was not the Bible. Nobody read a book in my entire house. We watched television on, and we had TV trays. We actually ate TV dinners on TV trays.
Wow.
And while we watched TV, which might be like a harmonic television.
I think so.
So I forget what the question is.
Well, just that what height were you, I'm wondering if you were an Annie, an Audie, or one of those lucky people
so
who
what
could
I'm trying
navigate
to say,
groups.
Right. So I found my tribe in the library.
Mm.
I remember my library card, which I could go into, but it's orange and it had a little metal plate. And the number
the
on the plate.
The numbers were punched.
Yes, the numbers were punched and they would ink them and my number was 3539, which today is my cell phone number.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
I was like, you know what? Can you give me this number? They're like, okay, lady. It's another middle-aged woman who wants her library card number. So basically, I loved high school because I had my little grouplet of geeky girls. I had braces. I know what it's like to pull it out. Mm-hmm. I love this jacket because
we're
it's
both wearing
forgiving.
Our jackets.
Doesn't, you know, and I've lost a little weight, no, but you know, yeah. I had my group, and you're lucky if you have your group. You don't even know you're an outsider group because you're insiders to each other, which is the wonderful thing. And we were joined by books. We were joined by just our love of reading.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Lisa Scottolini talks about how being a lawyer influenced her writing. Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Cynthia Canty of Michigan Radio talking with novelist Lisa Scottolini.
And it is wonderful. Amazing that, and let's see if you guys agree, everybody went through high school, that time is a great leveler. And if you go back to a reunion 20 or 30 years later, what I found is the people who were kind of the haughty, mean people were a lot nicer. We'd all been dealt some blows. And
right.
You also find out a lot of that haughtiness and a lot of what you saw as iciness, they were afraid too.
Exactly.
They were afraid
I think what
too.
You really find out, well, in American fiction has a great tradition of the outsider telling the story.
Yes.
Like, you know, Nick Carraway and Great Gatsby. There's a reason for that. Partly it's because he can tell you something with new eyes. Like, if you described this theater, this opera house, you've been here a million times, you go, oh, it looks like this, and we all know that. But I'm an outsider, and I come in and I go, well, or even to Traverse City. A, there's snow. Okay, it's April. Hello? But amazingly, B, I don't even mind because it's so beautiful, right? It's just like stone gorgeous. And then there's all this water. I'm like, what is that? So when an outsider comes into something, they go, what? Like I walked into this because we did a pre-check and all this stuff. And I'm like, look at this place. Like I've never seen chairs like you're sitting in a public place. Like it's remarkable. And I know you guys don't take it for granted because I know how well supported this event is. But so you're just always kind of describing things from the outside.
Yeah, it works so well. I want to talk about you then. You got your undergrad degree in English at the University of Pennsylvania, and Philip Roth was one of your teachers.
Yes,
what was that like?
Well, you know, if you're an English majors unite, he was teaching there, and so I had applied to get in the seminar, so it was about 12 people or so. And it's interesting because I think, first of all, I went to public high school, so I learned to write in public high school. But Philip Roth was a really good teacher of how to read. Like a little bit, for example, I've told this story before, but he taught me to look for the telling detail. So you might be reading Emma Bovary or whatever, that doesn't really matter. To take you back to something you might be familiar with, which was Nancy Drew. Yeah, it was formative to my writing. You know, when you think about Nancy Drew, the telling detail in Nancy Drew, I'll just short circuit this, is the Roadster. Do you remember the Roadster? Cynthia's has a convertible. We were talking about
it.
There's something
about a top-down day, but
yeah. There's something about, I think what Nancy, you know, you tend not to remember the top line of the Nancy Drew stories. They're all generally she's missing a clock. That's what I'm thinking. It's either a mantle clock or a wristwatch or a kind with the chain, the fob. Once a staircase is missing, I can't explain that. I know where my staircases are. That's it. But what you remember, I think, is the roadster, and that's because the roadster epitomizes who she is. Mm. She's a girl having adventures, by the way, in the driver's seat. Nobody's passenger. And I think that's why she speaks to girls.
I was a Hardy Boy fan.
I like Hardy Boys,
too. I love the Hardy Boys.
I like Cherry Ames, Army Nurse.
Oh, yes. There we go.
Cherry Ames,
Cherry
folks.
Ames. Shout out for Cherry.
So cute.
Well, then
the
you went to law school at, again, University of Pennsylvania.
Right.
And I see you were associate editor of the Law Review. And I got a kid in law school right now, and I know that's a power move. Making Law Review, but to be associate editor. You graduated with honors. And why didn't you pursue writing instead of going into law? Why law?
Because I was really money.
Money.
Just be real. I had to pay back student debt.
Okay.
My family had never had any money, and I had to earn money. And I didn't know how you became a writer to earn money. I spoke at a high school this week. And kids, you know, if you get out of their way and you let them just be creative and encourage them like you guys are and like this organization is, they really come out with stuff, and it's great.
But you had to pay bills.
And I had to pay bills. And I was like secretly, as probably many of you think, I wish, you know, I could write a novel. And I think you can. I mean, we're a nation of storytellers. Mm. Women know this because if you're in the ladies' room for any period of time, someone is going to start to tell you a story. And I always think, you know, when you go home tonight, somebody will go like, well, how was the thing? And you'll go, well, she might be a little crazy. But, you know, you're going to tell a story about tonight. And honestly, as I've told you, I like to demystify this process because you don't get more disorganized than I am. So if I just start a story going, what happened next? And I tell it to myself, that is a way to do it. You can do it that way. I've done it for 31 books now. And anybody can do that. My secret little hint, if you're thinking about writing, is to give yourself a writing quota. So you can have a full-time job. For the first several years of my life as an author, I had a full-time job because when you get published, it's not a living wage. And plus, I had all that student debt to pay. I was $40,000 in student debt. But if you write 50 words a day, no matter what, you will find yourself getting to the discipline. And also, I think of Hemingway at this time, believe it or not. I will cite him with approval, probably the only time I will. But when he says, write drunk, edit sober. Not literally. Look, I'm like this normally. Can you imagine if I drank? I've been known to grab waiters. It's very scary. So, but what you want to do is not be in your own way. Just let it flow. You can edit it later. I go through a whole book just telling myself the story, not allowed to go back and edit. And then edit when I know I have an ending.
But it amazed me as I read about you and realized that you clerked for judges in the state and federal appellate levels.
You did so much homework.
I do.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and I read your book.
Look at this.
You were a litigator for a big firm in Philadelphia. So clearly, those years practicing law inform your series, Rosato and D'Annunzio, and Rosato and Associates series. But when I think of this kind of writing. Not briefs, not case outlines, because I'm watching my daughter transform into a lawyer. And she said, will you proofread something? And I'll read this and go, my baby wrote this thing, this thing for IP. And so it's so different. And I would have thought maybe there was a fear that the creative side might have been stomped out by that legal writing. And it.
No, well, lawyers are some of the best liars around. I mean, let's be real. In a way, I think it's a similar skill and not the lying, just like the joke. But, you know, if you're thinking about what makes a good brief, or I clerk for judges, what makes a good opinion? Well, if you're going to, let's go back to the lawyers. You can't tell all the facts. It's like I was saying about the telling detail. You can't tell everything the character does, only the important things. So the process, are there any lawyers here tonight? Well, God bless you, because I love it and I missed it. And I think all of these stories about justice are really about lawyers to a certain extent.
So you miss it.
Absolutely. I love it. I love a good fight.
Okay.
So I get it out in these books. So a lawyer's task is to take a set of facts, throw out the extraneous ones, highlight the ones that really matter, and tell it in a narrative form. So anytime I stood before a jury, I'm telling them a story. I'm the real deal. So there's emotional truth in the novels, there's literal truth in the nonfiction I write, this humor. Mm-hmm. When I stood in front of a jury, I meant what I said. I felt it was true. If I couldn't pitch it, I'd tell the guy to settle. Because it's my integrity. And I honestly think, going back to what I said before, about if I don't cringe, you won't laugh, I think people, if they're listening with open ears and not in love, speaking of me, have a great BS detector. There is a ring of truth. Like right now, can you hear it? People generally know when they're being told the truth if they're not clouded by whatever's in the middle. And that's what I sort of clue into. Whether I'm telling a story, and when I was a lawyer, I clued into that too.
So what was the thing that nudged you to sit down and write?
It was honestly, you know, within the category of you don't know where life leads you, when my marriage kind of fell apart and my daughter was born, well, crowning.
Oh, boy.
She hates when I say that, but it's such a good verb.
It's a great verb. And every woman who's done that is like,
right,
oh, God.
Ladies, we've amen. And I was like, I have to change my life. Because when she was born, I kind of fell in love with her, and I had no alimony. I said, I told my dad I was making a statement, and he said, what's the statement, that you're stupid? Kind
tough
of.
Tough crowd.
Oh, I'm telling you. And then he was right. But I said, all right, you've got to change your life, and you've always wanted to write. And at that point, there was a guy named John Grisham, about whom you may have heard. And there were a lot of men writing books about male lawyers, but there weren't, there was nobody really writing female lawyers. And I actually thought back to Nancy Drew. And I was like, you're driving your own car, Scott Alini. You've been doing it for a while now.
Let's
just write what you know. So I think of them as, I think of them as stories about justice. And I also write, I mean, I write all kinds of characters.
And how long until you got, how much rejection did you have to deal with until you got
published?
Oh my
God, I love rejection. I thrive on rejection.
You
Ooh. Should, get, you get used to it if you're, 5 years of rejection. I lived on credit cards, which I paid back. I permit you me, can I tell you a cute story about
Please.
That? Okay, first off, my favorite rejection letter was from a New York agent who said, we don't have time to take any more clients, and if we did, we wouldn't take you.
Oh God.
You know, I saw that guy a few years ago at Book Expo, which is our big conference.
Oh, how fun.
Where I was the keynote.
How delicious.
Yes! Come on!
Vindication.
Vindication. That's a nice way for revenge. he comes to me afterwards. He wants to talk to me. He's like, Lisa. I'm like, oh, I don't have time to talk to anybody. But if I did, I wouldn't talk to you. Thank you. I told you I have a dark side. In any event, that wasn't the question.
But dealing with rejection.
So the rejection, and it comes. And I lived on credit cards during that time. It was a wonderful time because honestly, my main goal in life was to stay home with my daughter.
And you were home and she was tiny.
And she was tiny and we played all the time and it was just so important. For me, it was a personal choice. And by the time she was six, I finally got into print. Permit me the one cute story, because during that time we lived on credit cards, we did. So we could go anywhere that took credit cards. But we could not, we went to Chili's. Do you have Chili's here?
Mm-hmm.
So once a month, that was our big thing.
That was your date.
That was our date.
Big date, mother-daughter date.
But we could not go to McDonald's because then McDonald's did not take credit cards. So fast forward, of course it's the only place she wants to go because she sees the commercials rumble. So fast forward to when I finally sell a book, not for a living wage, but I got to pay off that mountain of credit card debt and we got to go to McDonald's and she's so excited and I have to teach her how it works. So I say to her, okay, McDonald's, you stand in the line, and then you look up and you see the menu, and she looks at it and really loudly says, but where are the appetizers?
Oh!
Every head turns. Who's this brat? I'm like, no, she's broke. She just has no idea.
Oh, gosh.
But I really, it's proof that there is a God that I got this wonderful career and this wonderful child. And
whom now you write with, which
I do.
Is even better. Yeah, she's grown up and she's wonderful and the two of you write together. We're gonna talk about that.
Okay.
How many books a year do you write? Because when you look at the list, it's a prodigious, I mean, it's the 32 novels, but you've got the nonfiction books. How many books a year do you turn out?
Well, I was doing two novels a year.
Good
and
Lord.
And I do the nonfiction books are part of a Sunday column I've written for 10 years. With my daughter, we alternate.
Which I'd be totally down if the Detroit papers or any of the Michigan papers would pick up. We would love to.
Oh, I'd
to
love that. Oh, my God.
That.
Well, I wrote that because I started to miss Irma Bombeck.
Yes.
And
it's
I was
very
like, Irma,
who doesn't miss Irma Bombeck?
Who doesn't miss Irma Bombeck?
Yay, Irma Bombeck.
And I was like, and I thought, I will admit to you that I felt a little weird because I secretly wanted to do it, but I felt distinctly inferior.
Okay.
And also didn't have the normal family. Like, right, it's me and my daughter. Like, Thanksgiving is us. It's two people. And so you feel that acutely. And then, permit me, I was at a library fundraiser, as in California. And somebody was talking, and I didn't always lead with the fact that I'm divorced twice, because it's not impressive, and I'm trying to impress you. So I was at this, and I heard women saying, I'm divorced three times, and I have three dogs, and I'm divorced four times, and I have four dogs, and I'm seeing a relationship, because I'm divorced twice, and I have five dogs, so I had a cushion. I was feeling good. I felt good about myself for a change. And as soon as I had that moment at that thing, I said to myself, you know what, Scottolini, you are thinking about this wrong. There's a lot of women like you, mm-hmm. whether they're widowed or divorced or never married, and we're just trying to make ourselves happy. We're rescuing dogs. I have a rescue pony. I got a cat with one eye.
Yeah, how many pets do you have?
I didn't even know at this point. I got 14 chickens. And
King Charles Spaniels rule.
Right, I'm just crazy about my dogs. And it's really just we're trying to make ourselves happy in this life. And so that's when I wrote a book called Why My Third Husband Will Be a Dog, which is really just about how much I love dogs and how that's okay.
Oh, my word. You know, some writers describe the process of writing as something that seems to us on the outside pretty damn torturous. I saw an interview, Ian McEwan was talking about the public world of being a writer, the readings and the interviews and events like this. And then he speaks of, and this is his quote, the private world of the closed door, the hiss of silence, and here we are again. What can you make come out of the silence? And I can't be sure I can do it again. So what's it like for you? How would you describe that sitting down and
Interestingly, is there anybody who lives, well, you don't have to out yourselves, but I'm going to guess that there are people who live alone. Okay. Now, let me tell you something. I kind of love it. And if you live alone, I learned this, weirdly, from my first novel, which had a scene in a cloistered convent. I went to visit a cloistered convent, if you imagine. Not a lot of conversation. And
vow of silence.
But it was one of the nuns, and I said, you know, especially for women, I mean, I love to talk, I love to listen, and how do you do it? And she said, well, our head is full of prayer. And I thought of that. And I live that way a little bit in that I think if you live alone, or even you have moments alone, we all have thoughts going on. Mm-hmm. So in a way, there's no hiss. There's no hiss of silence ever in my head. I'm always like, and I think also those of you, you know, especially when you're reading or if you write, you find that if you step away, it's still in your head a little bit, isn't it? These things, we are so cool and great in that we have our heart and our soul and it's always operating. So I think he's sort of right, but he's also sort of wrong. Sometimes it's in my head, and I can't wait to get, and I work every day, 2,000 words a day, seven days a week.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Cynthia Canty's conversation with Lisa Scottolini.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Cynthia Canty's conversation with Lisa Scottolini.
So this is novel number 32, and I'm wondering what is different in terms of your writing Someone Knows as compared to your first published novel. What have you learned? What do you do differently?
Well,
what do you do the same?
Look, all old people like me are big fans of practice, practice, practice. So I think it's really, and I encourage anybody to write, and you can start anywhere, but I do like to think, I try to improve. I think in the beginning, for me, I mean, maybe I'm trying to look cool, and you might, but I'm basically sort of insecure. So I had to push through a lot of things I thought about myself. Like I thought, Okay, you started writing women main characters. How will you write a man main character? You probably can't do that. And then I said, well, just try. I mean, you've had men you loved. You love Bradley Cooper. Imagine Bradley Cooper. That's my job. Imagine Bradley, and they pay me to do it. You know, and then I thought, well, you can't write in different viewpoints. For a long time, I didn't do that. And then I said, well, you have to. Book Like Someone Knows, you're going to know about a single event mm-hmm. that happens in time with lots of different point of views. And like you said, it was very kind of you. You know, can you land? I always think of the guy spinning plates way back when on Sullivan. Yeah. Can you land all these planes? I never thought I could do that until I tried it. I never thought I could write historical fiction. Now I'm trying to write historical fiction. I think it's really important. Well, look, you're living your life. I'm just a person living my life.
You have to give yourself permission to flop. And that's
exactly.
something. It's interesting. I was talking with someone about over the weekend about my perfectionist daughter, who is the daughter of a perfectionist mother. And when I see her, and does this ring bells where it's got to be perfect? It's got to be perfect that we somehow are afraid to fail.
Right.
And his comment, and he was an attorney, and he said, you know, it's kind of interesting because academically in school, girls excel. They work so hard. They put their heart and soul. Boys kind of like, yeah, you know, it'll work out. It'll work out. And he said, when you get into the work world, the guys will get further ahead because they just accept stuff's going to work out, whereas women can be afraid. It can muzzle you. You could be afraid to speak out.
That is so true. And that's how I felt.
Yeah.
And
because you don't want to get it wrong.
We get in our own way. I secretly say to myself, the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Ooh, that's good.
Really is a good thing. And it's also just like, I think it's a little bit about risk. Like I read somewhere that women come to writing much later than men. Because we finally, I'll secretly tell you, because we're talking here, a little South Philly in the house for you. When you think about you can talk about what's inspired you as a writer, Philip Roth, all these wonderful writers, but you know what gets you off your ass if you really don't are afraid to write? Read some bad books. Mm. Am I talking the truth for you? Haven't you read a book and you go, yuck, give me a friggin' break. That's a literary term, by the way. You go, I know I can write a book that's better than that. And I think that's a really important thing. I mean, I think Mindy Kaling, the actress, came out with an autobiography. It was like, why not me? Why not me? It's powerful. Jake Tapper's daughter, a young kid I saw it on TV, she came out with Raise Your Hand. I think there's a little bit of, we're a little afraid. We're not really socialized to do it. And that's why it's really important to try to get past that stuff. It's Anne Lamott, who's a wonderful writer and has written a great writing book called Bird by Bird. Says, give yourself permission to write a crappy first draft. You said the phrase, give yourself permission.
Yep.
It's really powerful.
In fact, this attorney said that some of the women in the firm, he's started to challenge them because he said there was one in particular who was on the bubble, could have made partner,
right,
needed to speak out more. And so his advice, he says, our whole new crop of first new lawyers are all women. And he said, I tell them every day, do something that scares you.
Right.
Every day, do something that scares you. That's so true.
And I think as a writer,
you have to do that.
You have to do it. Well, first off, I can't explain what the chemistry is, but I do think a little bit that if I don't know how the story is going to end, and I'm as anxious as you are, I think you feel me. Mm. Like I'm really like, ugh, and you got to be like, ugh. And I think there's something to that. So that whatever you're feeling really does get communicated if you're writing in an open-hearted, unguarded way, which is my job and sort of I come by natural.
Well, and I have to say, the chick wit columns that have been turned into these books that are wonderful that you do with your daughter, Francesca.
Thank you.
You know, my daughter is 25. How old is Francesca?
32.
All right. So we know that there can be mother-daughter moments. Right. And it made me wonder, what's that like working? Like, do you do tours together? Do you go out together? Do you fight?
Well, you know, part of the reason I started writing the column because about being a woman and getting older and like, looking in the mirror and finding your first gray chin hair.
Or finding that eyebrows vanish.
Oh, yes.
Thank God for microblading.
And you realize you're turning into an Amish man. It's great. Like, I drew my eyebrows before I came out. And I also plucked for you in the hotel.
Yeah. Who does? Baby. What woman doesn't?
Baby's bottom. Anyway.
That tweezers is in the makeup.
So I want to write that stuff. And then I realized I was talking so much about my daughter because I'm a single mother. I have nothing else going on. And then she's like, can I write? So then we both started writing. And so here's a perfect example. We don't decide what we're going to write in advance. So she writes from the point of view of a 30-something, and then I write from the point of view of a 30-something. And I can't believe I said that. But so one week, for example, she turned in this column, And it said, it was all about how she reads the wedding announcements and she's so nervous because she's 33 and she hasn't met anybody yet and they're 35 when they get married and she's got to meet somebody and she's all anxious. And at the exact same time, I was writing a column about how I read the obituaries. Oh my God, 75, that's a tick, 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 tick. You know, like we're neurotic. But you know, I like it because I am so crazy about my daughter. And she says to me, and I'm sure this will speak for a lot of your kids, which is when something really bad or really good happens, you're my call. And I thought there was not, just as I thought there were not enough women doing cool things in the lead in crime fiction, I thought, the positive image of a mother and daughter, yeah. It's such a tight, important relationship. It's not given enough attention.
That's great.
And I wanted to, so I always feel like I'm writing to a certain extent in a representative capacity. So we talk about our fights too. Yeah. And I talked about when my mom was alive being with her too.
Mother
I mean,
Mary.
That's the whole thing.
And I know that the two of you love Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. So you guys must have been in heaven when Star is Born came out.
I
in heaven.
We've only seen it six times.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's so literary, isn't it? Are you impressed yet? You should have Amy Tan. Somebody impressive.
You know, you have you do share so much of your life, and we learned a lot about your mother as we read these. Is there anything that the two of you have said, no, that's off limits, can't write about that?
I have no limit.
You have no
I limit. Will tell you the story that's, I don't know, am I taking up too much time?
No, we love that, yeah.
Okay, here's a quick
story.
My daughter didn't want me to tell this, but I did.
We won't tell. What happens in Traverse City stays in Traverse City.
So my mother, when she got older, I said, come and live with me. She would sell the house. I said, live with me because I love you and I live close by. She said, no, you're very boring. All you do is just read and write. And I'm like, I know. I'm going to live with your brother. And now my brother is gay and lives in South Beach, Miami. I give up. I'm not as much fun as that. Like, that's the definition. Like, they call it gay for a reason. Like,
I love it.
He's gay. And so she goes down. And one morning she wakes up completely convinced that there has been an earthquake in Miami. She wakes him up. Frank, wake up. He's MAGA back to sleep. She goes across the street. She wakes up the neighbor. Wake up, there has been an earthquake. The neighbor says, Mary, go back to sleep. She doesn't. She goes in the house, and she calls the Miami Herald.
Oh, dear.
I would like to tell you there has been an earthquake. They're like, lady, you might be crazy. She says, tell me your name. Do you understand this face? Mm-hmm. Because my mother takes names. She has them on a list. Do you know the name of the list? You're much too polite for me to say the name, but it begins with an S.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the things to do list. Okay. It's like, it's Newcomb of Hate. The name that Bob says, anyway, she takes his name, he takes her name. Which turns out to be a very good thing because 5 minutes later, he calls her back. Mary Scottolini, there has been an earthquake. She's like, I know. I tried to tell you that, and you made me feel old and stupid. But what is amazing about the story is that the earthquake did not occur in Miami, it occurred in Tampa. Do you understand? This is very far apart. But the
yes.
proof was that my mother called the moment it happened. So they sent a news van to the house.
Oh my gosh.
And my mother was on the TV screen, and underneath her face it said, Earthquake Mary.
Oh, Earthquake Mary.
And my brother, this is why my daughter doesn't want me to tell this, but my
fine.
Brother, who is the only gay man with absolutely no fashion sense, was wearing his mesh tank top for the cameras.
Oh, great.
Why? So that you could see the map of Italy tattooed on his chest. Milan is his left nipple. That's true. When they came to my mother and they said, how are you the only person in all, you can Google this, so in the Miami Herald, how are you the only person of all of South Florida who felt an earthquake that occurred in Tampa? She said, I know these things. Let me the kicker. I had her come up later because there was going to be a hurricane. And I said, you have to come north, because she was 4'11". And I was worried she was going to blow away. I'm like, you're coming north. She gets on a plane. She gets off the plane. She's angry. She's mad that I made her come up. And there's a reporter interviewing people. And he says, why did you come north? Were you afraid of a hurricane? I'm not afraid of a hurricane. I am a hurricane.
Oh.
Now, my mother didn't like me to tell those stories, but those are true stories. And
They're great stories.
Right?
Yeah, and
you can't write that stuff.
And when you look through the books, I have the emotional baggage claim, and you've got pictures of her at a dinner.
I know.
In there.
Thank you for that.
When did you lose her? When did she go to the next life?
Actually, it was Palm Sunday.
Oh, gosh.
So that was not a fun Palm Sunday.
Not a fun Palm Sunday.
But just a few years ago.
Oh, my golly. But it's fun to share, isn't it? I mean, not, you've got like all of these readers that...
Well, you do it. You do it because I think if you look at you. Is she a force of nature or what?
Oh,
you
thank
are.
You.
You're so open. You have such great positive energy. And I think I think we're unsung. I want to see in print the kind of women I'm looking at, the kind of women you are.
Well, thank you.
You know,
gosh.
I just really do. So that's why I write about my mom.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all forces of nature. I'm amazed by my friends. I'm amazed by my girlfriends. You know, I have one who has she's five kids. She's got one at violin and one at lacrosse. And somehow she makes it all work. Even at my age, even now, I bet you know, don't you always have in the back of your mind your kids' calendar, their schedule? You probably know it when your
the
kid
grandkids.
Gets out of class. And the
grandkids. The grandkids.
And whatever. I know I'll talk to my daughter at 6. She paid her taxes. She's all nervous, you know. I just think we are such glue, and I want a spotlight on us.
Now, you've done so much in legal thrillers, but you alluded to your next project.
Right.
You're going to shift gears. Tell us about what you're shifting gears
into. I am.
Into.
Well, since that Philip Roth course, we studied, part of the course was called Literature of the Holocaust, and the other was Literature of Desire, which was an unusual, odd combination. I know, but he's Philip Roth. Who's going to say, you know, you can't do that? Who doesn't want to read dirty books with Philip Roth? I'm like, okay. But the Holocaust, I read an author named Primo Levi.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to write about fascism in Italy, and I always wanted to tell an epic, because I love big stories. Mm. And as I've gotten older, I'm like, you know what, just try it. So it's a love story set in fascist Italy, and it's a love triangle, and we don't know who's going to live and who's going to die. And in the process... Because if all of my books are about justice and family, so is that
right,
one.
Right.
And it's very interesting to me, because when I taught my course, it's very interesting if we think about the law, as we said before, as being justice. I like to sort of turn that on its head, because that's happened in our time. Let's take for a minute, the laws in this country that said it was legal to take Japanese Americans and put them in internment camps. That was legal. Now, I'm sure that case would be differently decided today. But it's a very interesting problem when the law is itself unjust. Hmm. That's what happened in Nazi Germany. There were the Nuremberg laws. Mm-hmm. And that also happened in fascist Italy. There were the racial laws that were modeled on the Nuremberg laws. Although it was an interesting case because you thought, well, nothing bad will ever happen to the Jews of Rome because it's right in the holy city.
Yeah.
And will the Nazis actually have the nerve to do that? Will the fascists have the nerve to do that? What will the church do? How does this, all these very complex, big themes have to do with love and justice and family? So that's when I'm almost finished it.
Well, then this
called Eternal.
How do you research a story set in another country? I know it's your homeland in a sense, your spiritual home is Italy. But so you're talking about the 1930s, another era. How do you go about researching that so the authenticity is there? Because I'm a sucker for Tudor England.
Right.
I'm a sucker for World War II stories. So what's the process?
Well, it's really, it's been fascinating. And I research for all of the books, you know, write what you know. So
yeah.
I sort of know some law stuff, but I don't know all the law stuff. So I've gotten to be really good friends with, you know, homicide detectives and judges and all kinds of people in fields that are not mine. This book, interestingly, since it's about where is justice when there's no law and there's no punishment, I had to turn to religious analogs. So I'm sort of talking to rabbis and stuff and going...
Because you're not in any courtroom.
No, you're not.
Yeah.
What is our source of how to... What are the sources of how we govern our conduct? So going back with fascist Italy, I went to Rome, you know, wandered around, took notes, and deducted it, which was great. But, I mean, it's fascinating, and you really feel, interestingly, though, to make it come alive, mm-hmm. you have to, like, understand what, like, you know, Viale Testaccio looks like at 4 o'clock and where the sun is and what it smells like. It's all the cafeteria. You know, secretly, you're trying to make something come alive. And this is embarrassing to admit. It's so pedestrian. But sometimes in my head, I go the five senses. What are you smelling? What are you seeing? What, you know, all that's, whatever they are, I forget them offhand.
Yeah. We know.
You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Fill in the blanks. And So that's what I got out of Rome. That's what I really want to keep. But what's interesting to me is, even though there was a travesty there, that there was a mass murder in Rome. I've been to Rome before. My books are published in Italy. I've book toured in Italy. And until 2 years ago, there was no real monument to it. Now there's a very small one. Hmm. So you've got to research whatever it is. And that's the great fun. I mean, that's so fun. You know, you just get to experience it and put yourself in that situation and go, okay, what is that like?
And then uncork your imagination.
Exactly.
You know, I think of something, Marcus Zusek's A Book Thief just blew me away. My daughter-in-law turned me on to it. She, by the way, majored in English and then went to law school.
Huh.
And brings that. When I read your background, I went, my goodness, Megan, you could write a novel someday. Because
she could.
I think she was teaching a literature in the law course at Loyola Chicago.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's essentially what I did.
Because you're teaching now, right? Yeah. Talk about the course you're teaching now.
Well, I just stopped. But it was so great, and it was so entertaining, and it was so, I secretly started it. Look at me, I'm always a little propagandist. But I thought, having written so many books about lawyers, but also about the images of justice and culture. You know, you can look at culture writ large for that. My Cousin Vinny, right? Liar, Liar, the Jim Carrey movie, and the John Grisham movies. Law and Order. Mm-hmm. We have we're interested in these questions. And I secretly wanted to teach the course a little bit because I wanted them to understand that when lawyers do something, people generalize about it. Mm. And so when lawyers lie, that's a very bad thing. When lawyers don't follow the law, that's a very bad thing. And it's bad because people extrapolate that not only to lawyers, but to justice as a whole, and therefore to democracy. There's nothing more important to me. I love this country so much. And I'm a huge fan of its laws and of the Constitution. And when people mickey with that, you know, that whole part of what's going on in Someone Knows, as I said, it's interesting. Why does justice matter? Well, the answer is, in that kind of corny slogan, which is no justice, no peace. If we're not sure what justice is, and I think that's happening a little bit now. The instability makes us not peaceful.
We're churning.
We're churning, we're nervous, we're stressed out. Whether you're red or blue, you're all stressed out. And that's because we don't have the order that comes from a settled form of justice. And you can't even have love without that. So that's what I'm trying to explore, whether it's the domestic thrillers or the historical fiction or whatever I'm writing.
And you are magic. Lisa Scottolini.
That was Lisa Scottolini talking with Cynthia Canty. Lisa Scottolini's latest novel is called Someone Knows. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.